This is Fresh Air. Since the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, my guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman, has been treating people with AIDS and researching new therapies. He heads an innovative program at the New England Deaconess Hospital in Boston, which combines the research of new drugs with the care of AIDS patients. The program delivers care to over 1,000 people. 53 scientists are researching the virus and all aspects of HIV-related infection. The controversial artist Robert Mapplethorpe was one of Dr. Groopman's patients. The Mapplethorpe Foundation donated $300,000 to expand the program's laboratory. I asked Dr. Groopman why his clinic combines research and patient care, which are usually separate.
Our belief was that this fusion of the two worlds, of the clinic, the bedside, and the laboratory bench, really resulted in both better care for the patients, the ability to translate discoveries in the laboratory more rapidly into clinical programs, and also by observing an evolving disease like AIDS, one could take information from the bedside and bring it back into the laboratory and hopefully accelerate discovery there.
What are you testing now?
We're testing several programs. We're one of the lead centers in what's called active vaccination, that is, people who have recently become infected with HIV and whose immune systems still appear intact. We're trying to boost their own immune response against the virus by vaccinating them with genetically engineered components of the virus. We're also...
Let me just stop you. That gets down to the very kind of root problem of AIDS, which is the immune system. The immune system breaks down and leaves someone with AIDS vulnerable to every kind of infection.
Right. There are different ways of approaching it depending upon where someone is in the course of HIV infection. Very early on, as you know, there's a relatively long period of many months to several years where the immune system is still relatively intact. It's at that point that this particular program seeks to intervene to augment immune function and keep people there. There are also clearly people who have lost a great deal of immune function, usually reflected in a loss of so-called helper T cells. And then when that happens, there's really a different strategy that's applied. One is to try to limit the replication of the virus, and it appears that the virus is quite actively replicating in people with relatively advanced disease, and also to prevent the so-called opportunistic infections, the pneumonia, the encephalitis, and the other problems, the infectious problems that people with severe immune deficiency encounter. The key in people who have lost a large number of T cells, or the goal, is to try to determine how to reconstitute their immune system. And that goal has been relatively elusive to date.
And T-cells are a measure of your immunity.
Yeah, they're a rough estimate of your immune function. Most people who are not infected have helper T-cell numbers between about 550 and 1,200. People with very advanced HIV disease might have T-cell numbers less than 50, so one-tenth of to one-twentieth of where they would start.
So what else are you working on now? What else are you testing?
Well, we're working on another program called TAT, T-A-T. This is a very interesting new blocker of HIV that works through a mechanism completely different than the well-known drugs, AZT, DDI, DDC. This is a drug that blocks the expression, or what's called the transcription, of the virus. AZT works very early in the life cycle of the virus, after the virus first enters the target cell, and partially blocks the virus from making a copy of itself. Clearly, people have been infected with the virus long before they were ever given AZT, so that copies of the virus have been made within their cells and actually integrate within their own nuclei, within the center of the cell, within their own chromosomes. The TAT inhibitor in the test tube is able to suppress the viral components that have integrated into the person's chromosomes from being expressed and then from forming new infectious viral particles. So this is particularly interesting to us because it as I said, has a mechanism of action which is quite distinct from AZT and would presumably work well in cells that have already been infected and not simply protect virgin cells.
When you're working with people who have HIV and you're testing new drugs on them, how do you talk with them so that you keep up their hope but don't get their hopes up too high about the drug that you're testing?
Well, I think it's very important to be hopeful and to be optimistic. I've been involved really since 1980 in AIDS when I was at the University of California and the very first people were seen. So I have a perspective of more than a decade now. And there really is progress that has been made, and I believe there's tremendous progress that will be made in terms of new treatments. And I think that's important to communicate. On the other hand, many times things can look very promising in a test tube and fail to be effective clinically. So it's a very difficult process, and I think you need to both present in detailed and clear terms the rationale, the scientific rationale for a new experimental treatment, why you think that particular person may benefit from it, but also have the distance and the critical approach to discuss with the person why the drug potentially might not work and also what the toxicities could be. And then try in a partnership sense to make an informed decision together and go ahead with the experimental trial or not.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is my guest. Time for a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's chief of hematology and oncology at Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he runs an AIDS research and treatment program. He's also a professor of immunology at Harvard. What has made you most hopeful and what has made you most pessimistic in your years of AIDS research?
What's made me most hopeful has been, as opposed to many life-threatening and diseases like many cancers, where the cause is not identified and the basic biochemical and molecular mechanisms involved are still quite vague. In the case of HIV, we know what is the primary cause of the immune deficiency, and we know the genetic structure of the virus, so that we have a number of very attractive targets against which drugs can be developed. The first blush was AZT, DDI, and so on, which was against an enzyme of the virus, reverse transcriptase. And now, as I said, the TAT blocker, and there's something called a protease inhibitor, which is against another enzyme of the virus. So this is very hopeful. And putting those drugs together, drugs which have different mechanisms of action, my hope is that one can control the replication of the virus and prevent it from damaging the immune system and keep people in a relatively stable state of health for decades. What I think is the most frustrating and the most difficult are two things. One is the capacity of this virus to elude and mutate in response to these blockers. So this is a very diabolical and very difficult opponent in a way to sort of grab hold of and keep one's hold on. And the second is that people with very advanced HIV disease whose immune function is quite low have an evolving set of problems, most dramatically cancers such as lymphoma, which are very, very hard to treat.
How close do you let yourself come to your patients?
Well, I think you should get close to your patients.
That's funny because, you know, the thing you always hear is that you can't let yourself get too close to your patients because you'll get too emotionally involved and you'll just burn out.
Well, there is a high rate of burnout. I think you can't lose it, so to speak. I mean, you can't become so emotionally involved that you can't function in terms of making recommendations and helping in decisions and being analytical in terms of trying to make a diagnosis when there's an unclear problem. On the other hand, I think most of the people that I care for are young, in tremendous need, and quite attractive people in terms of their lives. And I think if you maintain a sort of cool emotional distance, it's not optimally therapeutic, to put it in that terms, and it's also just not the way I would want to be cared for if I were on the other side of the the examining table, if I were the patient and not the the physician. So I think burnout, though, is difficult to avoid in some way. I've avoided it.
How have you avoided it?
I think in part that I have a very strong family and a very good marriage and active, wild kids that keep me busy. I swim a mile every day, which is a good way to decompress. And I guess I'm able in some way to absorb a certain amount of suffering to a point that doesn't shatter me.
What have you learned from your patients about different ways in which people face death?
Well, I've seen incredible courage, I think it's most interesting, particularly early in the epidemic, when the social stereotypes of gay men from the 50s and 60s and so on, of being wimps and sissies and all of this, which is sort of the worst kind of images that they've been portrayed in movies and books and so on. I mean, here are people who had a courage and a dignity and a strength, an inner strength, which was and is unbelievable, of tremendous depth. And I think that has taught me a great deal about the resources that all people have in facing this. I think what's changed, though, in the epidemic and has made it even more difficult is that early in the epidemic, people who were very ill and were facing death did not have the sense that they were replaying images in their mind which were derived from seeing their friends in a similar situation. Right now, many of the people I take care of have had 10, 20, 30, 50 friends die of AIDS in the last decade. And they've been there at the bedside watching the weight loss and the vomiting and the encephalitis and the blindness and all the horrendous complications that can occur in the very advanced stages of AIDS. So that it's much more difficult having that concrete, immediate knowledge when you yourself are approaching that. And I think it's called for a greater degree of strength in people who are now facing it. And frankly, there are many patients who decide not to face it.
They decide to terminate their life.
Yeah, they decide to commit suicide in one form or another.
Do you worry about your own health a lot and about your own exposure to HIV? Do you get yourself tested often?
Early on, I worried quite a bit. In fact, I had an illness with fever and mild hepatitis in 1983, which with bronchitis, which really frightened me, and I thought I had AIDS, and there was no test for HIV at that time. Turned out I didn't have that. I had another infection. Currently, there's so much known about HIV per se that the delivering care to people is not a risk to me for HIV. What is a risk is tuberculosis, and this is a new problem which is of tremendous dimensions in the world, and a real threat to healthcare providers and essentially to everyone, because that is a communicable disease which is spread through the air. There are sort of two peaks and one valley of concern. There was an initial peak among physicians and nurses, healthcare providers, with regard to how is HIV spread. Then there's the valley of real comfort in knowing that we're really not at risk for HIV through caring for people in general. But now the emergence of tuberculosis has really changed the picture in terms of healthcare concerns for medical providers.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is the head of an AIDS program at the New England Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he also heads the Hematology Oncology Division. He's also a professor of immunology at Harvard Medical School. This is Fresh Air.